Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast on the rulers of the ancient world's most famous leaders. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XVIII, The Life of Claudius. When we last left Claudius, he had been made emperor, which no one, including him, had expected, and he'd used the power to conquer Britannia. In his role as Caesar, he would bring his own style to the position, and he would make decisions that the Senate didn't always agree with. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The Senate had a very ambivalent relationship with Claudius. It started reasonably well. He wasn't Caligula, which has got to be a good thing from the senatorial point of view. But they always felt like they hadn't been in charge of appointing him. They hadn't really been consulted. And he didn't always do what made them happy. So, for example, not too far into his reign, he introduced Gauls into the Senate. They're Roman citizens. Lots of people in Gaul have been enrolled into Roman citizenship. But he's taking kind of high up Roman Gauls and bringing them into the Senate, enrolling them in the Senate. And previously, only Italians have been in the Senate, and they sort of think of that as their area. So this is quite a shock, and it brings out some real prejudices, some real xenophobia from the senators. We don't have all of Tacitus's work for this period. He's a really important historian, so there's a big gap. None of Caligula is there. But about halfway through Claudius's reign, we get Tacitus back. And one of the earliest parts of that is where he discusses this introduction of Gauls into the Senate. And he gives us speeches from both sides and some really vitriolic speeches against the Gauls. They're barbarians, you know, we conquered them, we should be in charge of them, what would Julius Caesar think kind of stuff. But Claudius ignores that and he just kind of barrels it through. And these Gauls turn up in the Senate side by side with the Italian senators. So he doesn't always pay the regard to the Senate that it likes.
It seems a very petty and kind of exclusiveness on the part of the Senate to react this way and the way that they resist the rule of Claudius. So what do these decisions say about his attitude towards the Senate? Is he hostile towards the Senate in response?
I'm not sure we could say he's actively hostile to the Senate, but he is quite interested in the other social orders of Rome, and they feel that that's a snub. So, for example, he is an important mover in this ongoing trend to elevate the equestrians. They become more and more and more important. They've historically not had power, so the emperor can trust them. This hasn't been started by Claudius, but he continues it. But what he does that really annoys them, and it's something also that'll become an increasing trend, is that he promotes his ex-slaves, his freedmen, to really important positions of power. So within the palace, within his kind of inner circle, he starts to have a ministry. And he has a secretary and what we'd call a treasurer and people who look after his correspondence, and they're all ex-slaves, they're freedmen, and they've got real power. And we saw a little bit of this with Tiberius, but now it becomes kind of formalized that they have these positions and emperors will continue to have people in these positions and often they are freedmen. This is horrific to the Senate. These people have been the lowest of the low and now they have so much power. One of them, Suetonius tells us, was married off to three foreign queens. I mean, this is an absolute topsy-turvy version of Roman status hierarchies. It should never happen. So that really annoys the Senate. It's not clear whether Claudius was intending to go out and insult the Senate, but that's the way they take it.
I like that he's insulting the Senate in a very different way to that of Caligula. They're all finding their way to kind of tweak the Senate just a little bit.
Yes. Well, they can never let the Senate have too much power back because that could lead the way back to the Republic, which every emperor has a vested interest in stopping that from happening.
So what about the other aspects of being an emperor? He showed a lot of interest in judicial proceedings, didn't he?
We have a lot of accounts of his rulings on various matters and sometimes quite petty things. But unfortunately for Claudius's reputation, this seems to be because he's quite inconsistent. So the reason that historians tell us about them is they sort of seem perplexed. They can't work out why Claudius will execute some guy who's brought forward on a very petty charge, or there's no evidence against him. And on the other hand, where there seems to be a really compelling case, he'll be merciful or refuse to hear it. So unfortunately, the evidence we have is that Claudius was not very consistent and therefore not very well liked, but he was very interested in the judiciary and in hearing cases. And also in making new laws and thinking about the social order of Rome. He brought in a law that basically forbade you from harming your slaves for no reason. Claudius put an end to at least the potential practice that you had the power of life and death over your slave. He brought in rulings that masters and mistresses couldn't just for no reason at all kill their slave or torture them or do harm to them, which seems like something quite basic to us, but it's really quite important because up until then, you could have done that with immunity because slaves are mere property. And you could see this as an important point in Roman and indeed in European history where slaves start to be seen as people. They're given some form of human rights.
And I'm also going to bring up another edict that you're not going to like here regarding allowing public flatulence for good health.
I don't know what to say about that.
Good ventilation in the Senate.
Clearly somebody had objected to somebody farting and Claudius thought it wasn't a problem, which I guess sort of humanizes him.
And Claudius did write, better out than in.
He was also known, you know, for being a big drinker and from eating whatever he could see in front of him. So maybe it was one of his problems and he didn't want people to chastise him. But we are told that he was in charge of a decision in a law court, I think it was, and he smelt the smell of a sacrifice and a dinner being prepared for a ritual that he wasn't part of.
He still wandered off and helped himself.
Yeah, he just sort of stopped the proceedings and went over to eat.
So what did the people of Rome think of Claudius then, and what did he do to show his influence to them?
He didn't carry out any flashy building projects like Augustus did. I guess because Augustus had done that, you know, he had taken Rome very shabby and made it a gleaming marble place. But he also wasn't like Tiberius, who just kind of wandered off and forgot about Rome and didn't put anything on. So he did put on games. He did put on circus shows. He kept himself reasonably popular by doing this. He also restored the buildings where entertainment takes place. So, for example, the Theatre of Pompey was over 100 years old by this point. It's, you know, it's starting to crumble a bit, and he restored that. In terms of new building, it's mostly very, very practical, which is actually something that's helpful to the ordinary people of Rome. And famously, he built a new aqueduct. Bringing water into the city is something that's practical and important for the people of Rome. The aqueduct's called the Aqua Claudia. It's named after him, Claudius. And you can still see it in Rome. It's very easy to get to, actually. Within it now, there's one of the gates of Rome, the Porta Maggiore. And what you do is you go to Rome's main railway station, Termini Railway Station, and you sort of go behind the station. So not the direction you'd normally go into, towards the attractions of the city. Behind the railway station, the aqueduct is still there, and it's pretty impressive that it's stayed this long.
So that's Claudius the emperor. What was going on in his personal life at this stage? Because we know that the main preoccupation of an emperor seems to be securing who's going to come after you.
Well, Claudius had opportunities. He was married many times.
But he started quite late to be emperor, so this wouldn't have been a consideration early on in the days.
I guess not, but he did have offspring, not all of whom survived. He had four wives. Suetonius actually lists six. But two of those, we think, were when he was very young and might not even have been consummated. So there are four wives, and the last two are the famous ones, Messalina and Agrippina the Younger. And Messalina is the mother of his two children who do survive, a son and a daughter, Britannicus and Octavia. Britannicus is named after his victory in Britain. It's actually a title that's given to Claudius as well, and it means victor over Britain. Claudius, he's regarded as somebody who's kind of addicted to being married. And the word the Romans used for it was uxorius, from their word uxor, that means wife. But it doesn't just mean, you know, he wanted to be married to please his wives. It means almost that he was subservient to them. And this is one of the criticisms of Claudius, and one of the reasons he had a bad reputation with the Romans, was that he was seen as ruled by both his freedmen and by his wives. Two sets of people who, in the Roman systems of gender and status, should have been subservient to him. So he's not seen as somebody who's sort of in command of his own household. There's always a wife there who's ruling over him and sometimes tricking him. So, for example, with Messalina, his third wife, and the mother of his two children who survived to adulthood, she's kind of an inveterate adulteress. She's always having affairs, and everybody seems to know except the emperor, because he's so devoted to her that he doesn't really believe it. Messalina was supposed to have had an affair with Gaius Silius, who's known as the handsomest man in Rome, and even to have married him, which is obviously not possible because bigamy is not allowed by the Romans. It seems even that she was sort of setting him up to take over, to usurp the position of being emperor, or at least that's what was implied. And when this is uncovered, of course, this is treason, so Claudius has to have her put to death. So the mother of his two children is executed.
And he married once more after that to Agrippina the Younger. Judging by her name, she's got quite a prestige.
He swore that he would never marry again after the experience with Messalina, but his resolve seems to have lasted a very short time.
Well, as you say, addicted to marriage.
Exactly. And he started to cultivate Agrippina the Younger. Now, this was a problem for the Romans because she's actually his niece. She's the daughter of Germanicus, the sister of Caligula.
Sister of Caligula, yes.
So, yes, she has an amazing family background. And for the Romans, uncle and niece marriage is basically incest, and he has to pass a law saying this is okay and people can go ahead and do it. And apparently he's desperately trying to get other people to do this, but hardly anyone will because there's a taboo against it. There's been some very close family relationships, but there are certain ones, siblings and, you know, aunts and uncles, obviously parents, that are definitely taboo for the Romans. He does marry Agrippina the Younger. She's his last wife. And she is depicted as somebody very manipulative and somebody who even possibly brings about the downfall, the death of Claudius. She brings with her a son, Claudius' stepson, who is Nero.
So he's got two children by his third wife, and he's got an adopted son in the form of Agrippina the Younger's son, Nero, who I assume as a result of that is his great-nephew?
Exactly.
So how does this resolve itself?
Part of Nero being adopted is that he's married to Octavia. So that kind of seals his position. We've seen this before, I think, in previous podcasts.
So son-in-law as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he makes Britannicus, his own son, and Nero co-heirs. I don't know why emperors do this. If they looked back at history, they would see that it never works out, and it's not going to work out for Britannicus. It seems that Agrippina the Younger is very much behind promoting her own son, and that the reason Nero gets adopted is that he is listening to her. That seems quite plausible. And Claudius is getting quite old by this point, at least by Roman standards. He's in his mid-60s, so it's not that surprising when he dies in 54 CE. However, given the circumstances and the fact that Nero does very well out of this, there are suspicions that Agrippina herself was responsible for his death, possibly by poisoning him with mushrooms. Because Claudius dies and is given proper ceremonies, his remains are put into the mausoleum of Augustus, unlike Caligula, who had died under a cloud and was assassinated. And he's deified. He's the first emperor to be deified since Augustus. But this is a great boon for his successor, of course, to be the son of an emperor. So he becomes Divus Claudius, the deified Claudius. However, Suetonius says that Nero takes away this deification and that it's given back to him by Vespasian. Nero seems to have treated him with a great deal of disrespect. And this may have been a bit more general because Nero's tutor, who was the philosopher Seneca, he wrote a satire about Claudius's deification, so the process of making him a god, which really took the mickey out of Claudius and was nasty about his disabilities. And the real highlight of it, or you could see it as the low light, is this depiction of when Claudius gets to heaven and none of the gods can understand him, which of course is making fun of his speech defect. They don't know what language he's speaking. They think he looks like a monster. They get Hercules to come in because Hercules has fought all of these monsters in mythology. And they say to Hercules, is this your 13th labor? Is this some weird, bizarre hybrid that we can't identify? So all of these very kind of low comedy ways in which Claudius is mocked in this satire, which is actually called the apocolokintosis, a Greek word, which roughly translates as the turning into a pumpkin of the divine Claudius, the pumpkinification instead of the deification. So Claudius's legacy is a little bit double-edged. He's sort of given these honours, but it all seems a bit half-hearted.
So how is Claudius regarded in more modern times? Is he thought of as being a good and competent emperor?
He is compared to some of the others,
yeah, but
I think is
not
the
much
answer.
Competition.
Not much competition in between Augustus and Claudius, certainly, and with what's to come as well. His reputation is brought back by later emperors, but that might be a response to Nero, who is not going to turn out to be a very popular emperor. And I guess in modern times, there's been an increase of interest in Claudius. There was sort of a long time when he was a bit of a nobody because he didn't create any flashy new buildings. Because he's not a very glamorous figure, I think that there was a lack of interest, which was kind of turned on its head in the 20th century by the publication of a couple of novels written in the first person, as if by Claudius, by the classicist and novelist Robert Graves. And I, Claudius, really brought him back to the fore. And then there's a TV series created based on those novels in the 70s. So he's become a much more kind of popular figure. And the I, Claudius novels represent him very sympathetically. And all of the negative things that have accrued around his reputation sort of get explained away in those novels, even though they're clearly fictional and Graves didn't intend us to think of them as anything different to that. They have helped to re-establish his reputation and at least to encourage us to think about Claudius's motivations and what it might have been like for somebody who's born into a society where physical prowess and speaking ability is so widely regarded, and he has disabilities on both sides of that.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. You've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like the podcast, please share it with your friends. And go to iTunes, where you can subscribe and leave one of those really helpful reviews. And some of them have been great. You can find us on social media. We're both on Twitter. I tweet at NightlightGuy, and Rhiannon tweets at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. Emperors of Rome also has a Facebook page. And if I have a quick look, we just went over 150 people. So hello to 151 of you. Coming soon to Emperors of Rome, we come to the last emperor of the Julio-Claudians. He's rather infamous, and his name is Nero. Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.